pitcher Pete Walker, June 10th, 2008, in O-line. Listen, can you remember the way I try to start this thing? Can you remember your major league debut?
Oh, absolutely. Vividly. I remember it was in San Francisco in Candlestick Park, 1995, and I was pitching for the New York Mets. I had, I was just called up from Columbus against who we were playing the AAA Yankees. I was with the Norfolk Tides, and got the call that I was going to the big leagues. And I remember flying across country and landing in San Francisco, and coming in late at night. It was a day game the following day, but I got in late at night. I remember seeing the lights of the city, and it just, to me, it was all of a sudden, from the AAA cities and towns to the big league lights. It was kind of instantaneous there, driving in with the cabbie and just thinking, you've got to be kidding me. I'm in a major league city, getting ready to pitch against the Giants the following day or get an opportunity to get in there. And sure enough, the next day, that major league outing was an outing I'll never forget, because I remember when I finally got up in the bullpen and I had a chance to come in the game. It's kind of like being a deer in the headlights out there for the first time. I was kind of dominant at the time in AAA. I was having a great season. And got up there and just kind of forgot everything. And just was kind of lost out there. Just my eyes on the target. And the home plate seemed like it was 200 feet away. And I was nervous. I remember not being able to get any, it was just a cotton mouth feeling. And just extremely nervous. But the excitement of it as well was just overwhelming. Just being out in that major league field, all the work that you put into some of those years and finally getting the opportunity. I had a chance to face Barry Bonds that day. San Francisco, and I remember the paper and the wind there. You get a Candlestick Park, the paper swirling around me on the pitcher's mound, and the wind was gusting, and everything you see on TV. I was sitting out there, and it was real. And get a chance to face Barry Bonds and a couple of the giant hitters. It was a tremendous experience, I think I remember the nerves and the paper flying around more than anything else.
Do you remember what you did? You remember?
I did. I ended up giving up a run. It was an inning and two thirds. Barry Bonds ended up hitting a double, but he tried to stretch it into a triple and got thrown out at third base. So I think that was the second out of the inning for me. They put the bat on the ball pretty good. I was throwing a lot of balls down the middle of the plate, and wasn't really pitching, was just throwing out there. But I think the best part about the outing was when it was over, and I was able to get out of the inning, and just sit down for a minute and just kind of take it in. The damage wasn't too bad. Gave up a run in an inning and two thirds. And I was able to just take a deep breath at that point and just think, it wasn't awful. I didn't go out there and give up five or six runs. I got through it. And just the experience of being on a major league field with some of the guys on my team was pretty awesome.
Did it take you a long time to get there? You were in the minors a long time.
You know what? I wasn't in a long time, a reasonable amount of time. I was drafted in 1990 and got to the major leagues in 1995. So it was a kind of a steady progression. I went from rookie ball to A ball to high A ball to double A. They sent me back to double A to become a closer. Then I went to triple A in 1994, and then of course we had the strike. I would have been called up in September of 1994 had we not had the strike. So then the following year was a shortened spring training. I remember Joe McElvain telling me that we pitched well enough in spring to make the team, but we didn't see enough bad things from a couple of other guys, so we're going to give them first crack, so we're going to send you to AAA. So I finally got the call in the summer while I was pitching with Norfolk. So it wasn't a long ride there.
Do you have any special minor league memories, like coaching managers that you played for? Was there an exceptional manager there?
In the minor leagues, I would say there was a pitching coach, Randy Neiman, who was with the New York Mets different capacities over there. He's been a pitching coach there. He's been a bullpen coach. He's been a minor league coordinator. He was one of my first pitching coaches. So I have a nice relationship with him. Bob Apodaca as well is out in Colorado now. He was with the Mets as well early on. So a couple of pitching coaches that I really took to, and they seemed to like me, and I had a great relationship with them. They were very encouraging and worked on mechanical aspects of the game, the mental aspects of the game. I thought they were tremendous. From a managerial standpoint, the one manager that still is my favorite of all time, and not even close, to John Gibbons, who I had a chance to play for the major leagues as well with Toronto. But he was my, it was actually when I was kind of coming back after a couple of surgeries. I was with the Mets in 2001, and he managed me that year and really gave me my first opportunity at being a starter against. I'd been a reliever for so many years, and the Mets discussed it. He thought I'd be great at it, and you know, I played for him that year in Norfolk and ended up, you know, winning 13 games and kind of putting myself back on the map. And of course, you know, leading to down the road, I ended up getting a chance to play with him in Toronto, with the manager in Toronto. And it was really nice to kind of, and again, he gave me the ball and said, "Here you go." You know, so it was a great relationship I've had with him. I thought he was hands down the best manager as far as dealing with players and getting the most out of his players. Not a kind of a dictator out there, not demanding things. You know, he earned the respect of the players, and the players in return gave him that respect that he deserved.
How important, looking back now, Peter, how important is it that you get the right, that a kid gets the right manager?
I think it's real important. You know, I think early on, I think a lot of kids in high school, you know, I think they're coddled, you know, especially with the parent involvement and everything else. They're told they're, you know, they're the best. And I think once they get into professional baseball, I think it's a quick realization that there are a lot of good ball players out there. So I think that I've seen it when I've been down in the minor leagues, or whether I'm rehabbing or something else. There's a lot of mixed emotions in some of the young kids where they're unsure. They're unsure if they're good enough. They're unsure if they're working hard enough. And I think getting a manager that can kind of relate to the players and get the most out of the players can change a kid's career. You can get stuck with some managers, and I have been, that have what I thought were good managers or good players managers that were more of the organizational guys that really just did the black and white. But I think the managers that I played for that tried to have a personal relationship with the players are the ones that get the most out of them. And I think they give you a little bit of confidence, you know. And I think for young players, and there's so many even players out there, players with even ability, equal ability, that I think just having someone who gives you that confidence, has the confidence in you that you can do the job, is sometimes the difference. And I think that's you know, really important to find that. Although, as a player, you have to be able to, if you're in a situation that isn't a great situation, you have to find a way to do your job and get the most out of your ability. And there were times where I had to do that myself. So it definitely helps to have a manager who will, you know, build your confidence with you.
How'd you get started playing baseball?
I grew up in an athletic family. You know, I had four older brothers, and, you know, grew up, I was the youngest, so kind of thrown into the fire at an early age, playing with the older kids, every sport, whether it's basketball or baseball or with the ball in the backyard. You know, I learned quickly to compete and to try to keep up with the bigger guys. You know, you had to find a way to get it done. And I think, you know, I learned by going to their games, you know, watching, you know, not every, you know, I think usually the oldest one leads the way, and the youngest kind of, you know, reaps the benefits of being around an athletic family because you're constantly in games and grow up in that environment, so that's all you know. So, you know, it was at an early age, you know, 5, 6 years old, I was swinging the bat and throwing the ball and never really stopped. You know, I was involved in baseball at every level and had great encouragement from my parents and, you know, dealing with all the kids and getting everybody to the fields on time. And you know, it was a situation where I just felt that, you know, it was, you know, it was kind of instilled in me.
When did you come to East Lyme?
We moved here when I was 5 years old. I was born in Beverly, Mass. My brothers had already gotten involved in Little League in Beverly, Mass, and we moved here when I was 5 in kindergarten. So, you know, it was at an early enough age where it was an easy adjustment for me.
But the East Lyme is your whole youth career.
Definitely. Yeah, East Lyme.
You're an East Lyme boy.
I am an East Lyme boy. I grew up there. I played Little League with Brooke Fordyce and Kyle Regan, another name, you know, guys who played professionally. Yeah. You know, we grew up with a real tight-knit group. The East Lyme Little League program was fantastic, you know, back then. You know, I remember going to a state championship with those guys and losing to Stanford, so I remember those things vividly.
Were you pitching?
I wasn't a pitcher. I was actually a catcher and a second baseman. And you know, I was a catcher and Brooke played the infield, you know, kind of reversed a little bit, but he became a catcher. But I remember those days.
Same team, excuse me, Peter, same team?
Oh, yeah, we
you
played
and
the same
Brooke
Little
were on
League team.
The same
oh,
team?
Yeah, same Little League team. Yeah, he was the catcher and I played second base. I pitched a little bit too, but I was, you know, I played second base and I caught when Kyle Regan pitched because Kyle Regan caught as well. So I used to love catching, but my knees in those middle ages, like the 13, 14.
But Brooke was mostly not a catcher.
Berkeley was a shortstop. Berkeley didn't start catching until a senior in high school.
Right. Yeah,
Jim Powers made him a catcher because of what we talked about earlier, you know, the position that the scouts are looking for. Yeah.
Certainly not an exceptionally big guy, is he?
No, exactly.
Do you have, you say you lost that game in the state championship?
Oh, yeah.
And who pitched?
Who pitched in that one? Jeez. I think Kyle Regan pitched. I think I caught. I might have played. I think we made a couple of changes through the game. So the Stanford team ended up going to the World Series that year. They were a pretty strong team.
Okay. And this was not the final.
This was the state championship. This was the final.
For the state championship?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 1981. Yeah. So, a tough one to swallow.
Yeah.
So we had.
Do you remember anything about that game? Do you remember that they beat you?
I remember that they beat us. I want to say 11-6 or 11-7. But I know we made we were big on making late rallies, and we were a team that never gave up. We had a lot of good little competitive guys on that team, and we played them extremely hard. So I remember that. I do remember that game. So.
And then you played for Niantic.
I played for Eastland High School, obviously. Okay. Beirut, the Eastland High School, Niantic Legion. Played for Bill Jerome, the late Bill Jerome there. It was great. We had a lot of good teams. You know, again, Brooke and Kyle Regan and myself. And we battled New London. You know, we were stuck in the same zone with them. So they had some great teams. They had a lot of guys that played professionally as well. So, it was a real competitive time. And I think it was one of the best times for Southeastern Connecticut, to be honest with you, as far as Legion ball. I think there's a lot of coaches out there who would agree with that.
But all this is leading to the game. I mean, you're just becoming deeper and deeper in the game.
Yeah, but you know what? It's funny. I never had the feeling that I was going to play professionally or that was my goal. I just played. I just played the game. It's different now where kids are going to showcases and kids are being, you know, flying all over these different places on the East Coast, and they're really involved in a lot of different programs, the AAU and the... And we just played seasonally, and it was a little bit different back then. Now I probably would have been more aware of professional baseball, and I don't think I understood professional baseball until I was 2 years into it. You know, I mean, even in college, the scouts started coming around. I was like, oh, okay, you know, this is unbelievable. It'd be great, but didn't think. I don't think I had a great self confidence or high self esteem at that time. I just always kind of, you know, was trying to. I wasn't a superstar by any means. I was a good player. I was a good player.
But Eastline was a great team.
We had a great team, and I fit into that great team.
I mean, and you pitched there.
I pitched there, I pitched there, and we went to a state championship, and we lost. I was a pitcher then, and I kind of came out of nowhere and had a good junior season. I went 10-0, but it wasn't overpowering. I was a low 80s fastball, and just threw a big curveball, and just kind of knew how to compete and pitch, and had a great team behind me. So I didn't develop any strength really until I was a freshman or sophomore in college, where I started to get a little stronger.
But a good coach, a great coach.
Where's that?
In Eastland.
Oh, Jim Littlefield. Yeah. You know, when you talk about one of the best coaches in Southeastern Connecticut history, he's one of them. You know, and the way he kept the team unity and took a lot of pride in Eastline baseball. I mean, we had the sweatshirts, when we jogged as a team. We had a little march, Go Vikes thing that everybody had to say, and it was like the. But I mean, he was very. We worked on the field together. He worked on the field together. Was a good X's and O's guy on the field, you know. And looking back to the mechanical end of it, there wasn't a lot of work on our mechanics. It was playing the game. You know, you pretty much figured it out, and you put the bat on the ball. And as a pitcher, you know, there was some mechanical adjustments that they would make, but for the most part, we were out there competing. And
you say you weren't a prospect. You don't think you were a prospect in high school?
No, I don't.
Why did the college find you? Why did
I went to Avery? Well, Avery, I did. I was recruited. I mean, I had such a good junior season, so there was some interest. But I wasn't an overpowering guy. I didn't throw in the high 80s. You know, I wasn't a guy that they were just throwing scholarship money at. You know, I had some partial scholarships. I had some Virginia Tech and Seton Hall and a few teams in Maine. You know, I'd gone on recruiting visits. But I really was... I lacked self-confidence at that time. I wasn't very strong physically, and I decided to stay put and go to Avery Point to play for Coach Bidwell, who my brother had played for, and loved the program over there. And I could stay home and kind of get myself back on track from a confidence standpoint, you know, strength, get a little stronger. I didn't know if I wanted to be a hitter, a position player or a pitcher at that time, so that gave me a chance to go do both. And, you know, it was an opportunity for me just to kind of grow another year. I think I was a little immature at that time in my life, and it just was a great opportunity for me to grow.
But another great team.
Another great team. Played for Coach Bidwell over there. I mean, he's one of the probably from a collegiate standpoint, you know, between him and Coach Baylock, I mean, you can't ask for two better coaches. Caring, you know, passionate, and I think Roger was just a great example of if you're looking for a college program, that's the kind of coach you want to go play for. And he gave me an opportunity to pitch and hit, and you know, and I still, even playing there, I didn't know what I was going to do with the next level. So I was afforded that luxury of being able to continue to do both, and I figured I'd do both as long as someone told me I could, you know. So we had great team there, and I played for a great coach. Then I had the opportunity to go to the University of Connecticut.
Tell me about Andy.
Yeah. I mean, he is probably...
Is he what people say he is?
There's no question. There isn't a... I mean, his desire to get the most out of his student-athletes is just incredible. And he gave me the ball up there. He gave me an opportunity to pitch. And you know, he gave me the ball. He didn't come out to get me. I was out there for 7 or 9 innings, whatever it was. And, you know, he showed extreme confidence in me in every situation. He gave me the ball in every big game while I was there, and gave me the opportunity to be seen by the scouts and put myself out there. And really, I think what I needed was confidence. Believe it or not, you know, that push that you're the best guy for this job right now. And then I started to believe it, and I think that's when my career kind of took off. You know, I started to be a more effective pitcher. I controlled the game. I controlled the tempo of the game. It's because really that he gave me the ball when I need to be given the ball.
Okay. So he was, if not the key, a definite key.
You know what? I was fortunate. You look at the coaches that I had.
Yeah.
I had good baseball people, guys that cared. They were passionate, and you know, from Little League all the way up. East Lyme was a great town to grow up in, and I think, you know, Roger Bidwell. Was instrumental in me getting to the major leagues for certain reasons. Coach Baylock had a lot of input. I just think I was fortunate to have quality instruction, quality coaches at that time, more so than a lot of people get.
Okay, you were, what, your senior year or junior year? You won the Big East.
My junior, I won the Big East and had a chance to go pitch, you know, in the Northeast Regional. We played at the University of Georgia, who was they were number 4 or 5 in the country at the time. Dave Fleming, I don't know if you remember Dave. And, you know, Coach Baylock. Me and actually Jason, there's another pitcher, Jason Froning for UConn, who was throwing the ball extremely well. Actually, was probably a little hotter than I was, but when the push came to shove, and, you know, we went to that game against Georgia, you know, Coach Baylock came up to me and said, you know, you're pitching the first game, absolutely. And, you know, you're going to go out and give us a great effort. And sure enough, you know, it was a situation where I got the ball in that game, and it was I know he still talks about the game because it was big for the UConn baseball program. We had about 8,000 people at the game, and we went out and played them really tough, and we had some chances, you know. A couple of breaks here and there, you never know, we might have snuck it out, but we took them deep into the game. I remember there were probably 20 or 30 scouts at the game, you know, cross-checkers and everybody else standing in the back, which really I was kind of unaware of at the time, to be honest with you. I found out more of that after. That was a game that these people really saw me and saw that I could compete and, you know, against the best in the country. And, you know, I know my velocity was pretty good that night, too, which didn't hurt. But that game was probably, I remember walking onto the field that day, because we worked out, we stretched out and played catch and took BP on a side field. And then probably the game, I don't know what game time was, but as game time approached, we walked over as a team. The place was full, and I remember like a standing ovation as we walked into the field.
This is where?
This is at Waterbury.
Municipal stadium.
It was the old municipal where all the stands were on one side.
Yeah. And the track went through the
infield. Yeah, but it was just incredible walking. That was my first experience with really feeling that euphoric feeling of being out there competing in front of people.
And this was what year?
This is 1990.
Okay.
And, you know, 8,000 people standing applauding you. I could just feel my energy and just.
Now you had pitched. Did you pitch the winner? Did you pitch the clincher, the Big East clincher?
I pitched the Big East clincher against Villanova.
Right.
and which you know, the 1-0 game was one of the better games they say was pitched in the Big East tournament, I guess, historically. But I threw a shutout, and again, that was a real good day for us. And you know, I had a chance to receive an award up at UConn recently, and you know, the Distinguished Alumni Award or whatever. But I had a chance to, you know, get up there and pay tribute to Coach Baylock and some of the people who are so instrumental in getting that opportunity. But just great memories of UConn.
Is there anything about that game you remember? Was there ever a situation where you were in real serious trouble?
Oh, absolutely. It was 2-2, and it was late in the game, 7th or 8th inning, I think maybe the 8th. And it was 2-2, and I could have been out of the inning. I had 2 outs. I believe it was 1st and 2nd, or 2nd and 3rd. First base was open. And I ended up walking one of their big hitters. I can't – the names. If you told me who it was, I would be able to remember it. But it was a full count, and I threw a slider right on the outside corner. I mean, it was – to be honest with you, it was a perfect pitch, exactly where I wanted it. And if it was a strike, I was out of the inning 2-2 going, you know, with a chance for us to come up the bat. And instead, it was called the ball. Of course, Coach Baylock went nuts, and Eric Dubinsky behind the plate went nuts. And I just stood there kind of like, oh, you know, it hurt. And I wasn't too happy. So I ended up walking him, and the next guy hit a double in the gap. So it played at 3 runs, or 2 runs. So we went from a 2-2 game in the 8th to 4-2, and then we just kind of got deflated a little bit. We didn't make much of a rally in the night.
No, that was the Georgia game.
That was the Georgia game.
I'm talking about.
Oh, you're talking about Villanova.
Villanova game.
I remember.
He is getting old.
I am getting old. The Villanova game. I mean, I just remember it being a great, I guess, a pitcher's duel. I mean, every at bat was you know, because it was a 1-0 game. Every at bat was crucial. And I just remember, you know, to be honest with you, I remember the game against Georgia more as far as the innings and what went on. The 1-0 game was just, I think I was inside tunnel vision in that game. And just every hitter, I was just attacking every hitter and trying to get through the game. So it was kind of a pretty fast game, not a lot of excitement. And it was kind of, you know.
Let me ask you this. You remember the run? How you got the run?
It was a... I can't even tell you for sure.
I know.
I think we had a couple big hits. It might have even been a pass ball or something. It was something, you know, it wasn't spectacular.
All I know is that it's considered one of the great games in UConn baseball history.
Yeah.
It's with the game when they beat Texas in 1972.
I know, and I think part of it, so I've been asked that before, and I remember Little League stuff, but I think that was a game where it was just so, everything was, I was just so focused on what I was, all I saw was Marek Dubinsky's glove. You know, I remember him calling the signs, and I was just throwing. And everything else that happened, I think that's really when I started to get that tunnel vision as a pitcher, when you just get in the zone.
But, Peter, that was a key game in your career.
Yeah, it was. There's no question. Again, that was a key game, and I think the Georgia game put me over the hump.
Did you expect to get drafted? At that point,
I knew I was going to get drafted. Coach Baylock had told me. I think early in the year, I was kind of like, yeah, we'll see what happens. Maybe thought, and he came up to me one day and said, you know, don't worry about all the scouts coming to the games. You're going to get drafted. Just concentrate on pitching, and who cares what round it is? Just go out and do your job, and you're going to get an opportunity at the end of this to go play professionally if you choose. And so I kind of knew going into those games that there was a chance. But I knew once I threw a shutout against Villanova and I threw effectively against Georgia that it was going to happen. I just didn't know when or with who, or, you know, I talked to a number of
interesting question. Do you remember who the umpire was that made that call?
No, but I'm sure Coach Baylock does. I don't. And you know what's funny about that, too? There's another reason why I find I need to pay more attention to these things, because even in professional baseball, a lot of pitchers say, you know, get to know the umpires because it's nice to be able to talk to them between innings or say something to them. I couldn't tell you who was behind the plate for a lot of my games. I would get out there. I remember warming up in the bullpen. I get out on the mound, and I'm just going. I just get into this mode where I just see the catcher and the catcher's mitt, and that's all I'm concentrating on. So I didn't take the time to know some of the umpires. All I saw was the mask, and to me, they all looked the same. And I'm sure a lot of umpires wouldn't appreciate that, but I think that's why I became somewhat effective and was able to do what I was able to do. I know there are a couple of umpires who I went to school with at UConn who I definitely recognize. Jim Reynolds was a UConn grad, can't think of his name right now. Another UConn grad that we run into every once in a while. But other than that, I didn't pay much attention to that.
In your whole career, can you remember another pitch that you thought you should have got, didn't get, and the result was?
As bad as that one? No. That definitely stands out alone, but I'm sure there are a lot along the way that I didn't agree with or that hurt me in some capacity. But no one pitch that stands out more than that 3-2 strike that was called a ball. Really, in professional ball, I'm sure there are some pitches that hurt that if they went the other way could have changed the course of the game, but not like the one in Waterbury.
Tell me about rookie ball. Who's that? I mean, where'd you go?
Talk to you later. Rookie ball. My first year pro ball in 1990, I went to Pittsfield, Mass. And I was drafted with Mike Sorrentino. There's a Central Connecticut All-American first baseman that they drafted as a pitcher. So me and him went down to Florida for a week. We, got accustomed to the New York Mets jersey and practicing a little bit in spring training. And then we went to Pittsfield, Mass. And again, to me, that was the major leagues at that time. Coming from where I was at, even though it was a Pittsfield Mets jersey, playing in these professional games and it was just an awesome feeling. That was probably the most fun I've ever had playing. Great bunch of guys, kind of a college mentality, and just a real loose group. If I never made it past Pittsfield, Mass, I would have been happy because it was just a great experience. Being a part of that team and to some of them, it was their major league experience. Because a lot of them got released or cut or that was the end of it. But I remember that team was very close. The guys hung out together. We on and off the field. Very tight-knit, and I think as you go through professional baseball, you climb the ladder, that changes. You get a lot more little groups, cliques, guys go their separate ways, especially in the major league after a game. Everybody's going to their families or going, so it's a different atmosphere. But early in professional baseball, you eat as a team, you go out as a team, you have a beer as a team. Just little things like that. And I just think that was a probably my most memorable part of minor league baseball, the first year or two, that camaraderie.
That was New York Penn League?
That was New York Penn League, yes,
okay.
Pittsfield.
And you got to play in one of the most famous stadiums in the country.
Yeah, I remember the sun coming down and stopping the game. I'd be all warmed up, ready to go, and throw about 8 pitches. Next thing you know, they call the game for half an hour.
Did that happen often?
It happened often, yeah.
Really?
I think now, I know it's not, I think it might be an independent team up there now, but I think they put something up that was permanent. I'm not sure. I haven't been back there in years. But it was a good old Pittsfield, Mass, and that stadium was, it was a lot of fun to pitch in, and I still have memories of some players. Run into some every once in a while that have stayed in professional baseball in some capacity, whether it's front office or whatever.
Who was the manager there?
Jim Eschen.
The old catcher?
It was another Jim Eschen.
Oh, okay.
It was another Jim Eschen. It was very good, very versatile, and kind of a dry sense of humor, but he was really good to us. Randy Neiman was my first pitching coach. We struck up a great relationship right away, and it was a fun group.
And you had a decent year?
I had a decent year. They brought me to what they call the instructional league, at the end of the year where they take a few of the prospects from each team and they go down and work out for a month. So, I think that was more based on ability than numbers. I think I was maybe 5-7 with like a 4-year ERA. A lot of strikeouts. My strikeouts were, I think that's where my fastball went. Even though it was good, I think I really developed, at Villanova against Georgia. My velocity had jumped a few miles an hour, and I got into professional baseball, and it jumped a couple more. And I was throwing in the low to mid-90s. And I don't think I barely, in my college career, until that Villanova-Georgia game, I was probably mid to high 80s. And all of a sudden, I had a 90-mile-an-hour fastball. I felt I was playing baseball all the time, stretching my arm out, playing every day. And I became a more powerful pitcher.
Talking about emotion, when you got through that next year and you weren't released, was that a big deal?
Yeah, you know, because again, I didn't know anything going in, so I didn't know. I remember my first experience the following spring training, and seeing going in and just thinking, you're going to be with this group forever. You know, that was my perception. We're just going to go all the way to the major leagues together. We're going to be together. And all of a sudden, it comes down to your first cut day, and I'm being a rookie and not understanding it. And I knew I was safe at that point because they had told me I was already penciled in to be a starter in St. Lucie, which is their high A level. So I wasn't really concerned about that, but I didn't know what to experience. And I remember Brooke Fordyce telling me this is a bad day, blah blah blah. And I remember sitting in the locker, and that morning they'd come out and they were like vultures. The coaching staff, the pitching coaches from different levels, and the hitting coaches, they'd be grabbing guys one at a time, and they would. And we'd be sitting there just in a locker, just kind of watching, mulling around. And you're just watching. You see one of your good friends all of a sudden get tapped on the shoulder. And, they say, coach or Jerry Hunsaker at the time, who's the director of minor leagues, wants to talk to you. And you knew right away. You don't even have to bring him in. You just got released. But they bring you in. They discuss what's going on and what they have to do and sign the paperwork. And, we're going to get you on a flight to so-and-so to get you back home. Then they come back out. Tears in their eyes and filling their bag, and you're over there like, wow, this is just amazing. They see someone's dream just crushed right there.
This is the second, we're talking about the spring training.
This is my first spring training. When I was drafted, it's the June draft. So you go down to Florida for a week,
right.
And then you go to your short season, which was a pitch.
But you already knew, Peter, that this wasn't going to happen to you?
I knew it wasn't going to happen based on going to the instructional league, based on what the coaches were telling me about. It looks like a big year for you. We're really looking, get you 25 starts.
But this affected you.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I've always been kind of a sensitive person, which to a fault, and I think that led to my immaturity at an early age, because I really took things to heart and things bothered me. So, seeing some good friends get released and knowing how upset they were, and I've seen it affect guys for a long time after. I've talked to them. I've seen guys go into depressions. I've seen guys use drugs. I've seen guys still complaining about getting released. I mean, so there are things that deeply impact these people. Yeah. And you could see it that day. You knew it wasn't something that was just, all right, I'm going to go back to finish school, or I'm going to go get a job. It was crushing. It was really crushing. So, I think I'll always remember that as a real emotional time. And I remember watching it and just, I don't want this to happen to me. I think that even made me hungrier, to keep that from happening.
And it continued, though, right? It continues. Does that continue on?
Oh, yeah. There's probably three or four cuts.
But I mean, as you get older, you move up the ladder.
Definitely. I moved pretty quick. I had some successful minor league seasons. I put up good numbers for the most part. Not necessarily wins and losses, but in the other categories. And I knew I was moving in the right direction. So I never had that feeling early on. Especially, I was put on the roster, in 1993. I was relatively safe. It was really the guys, unfortunately, you talk about lower picks in the draft, guys that they don't spend, there's not a big investment in, that if they're not a standout player, there's going to be someone else that's going to come right along. I mean,
Did you get to a point when it didn't bother you? I mean, did you get to a point, say, this is part of the game?
It didn't take that long. I mean, you started to get and you knew what to tell people, too, because I remember early on, I didn't know what to tell the guy, whether he was sitting next to me or, what do you tell him? You still have a uniform on. They don't really want to listen to you unless it's going to be okay. Hey, give me a call and get exchange numbers and just the typical baloney, But as I got older, I knew that some of these guys had a chance to get back in the game. There was an independent route. There was maybe another team that would pick them up, based on, what level they were at. If they got to AAA and had pretty good numbers, there's a chance someone else would give them an opportunity in a different organization. But, and I think I became more aware and understood the game, so it didn't bother me as much. But I think initially that initial cut day, it's just...
You said that Fordyce, he was a Mets pick too, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Same year?
He was the year before.
Okay.
It was the year before, so when I got there, it was nice having him there because he'd already kind of seen the first year.
Okay.
And even though I was, he was a grade behind me.
Yeah.
I was coming out of college; he came out of high school. Actually, he was 89. I was drafted at 90. He was two grades behind me, but he was only 1 year younger.
Okay.
So by the time my junior year came, he'd had a full season of minor league ball. Okay. So, um, So, yeah, so it helped having him down there. I remember living with his parents at a place in St. Lucie on Jensen Beach, so they'd have me stay right with him. You know, so me and him had the place to ourselves for the summertime while we played in the Florida State League. We had a great relationship for 5 years playing together. We did everything together. And then, you know, we finally got to the major leagues in the same year, but for different teams. It was weird because he started off in 1995 with the Mets because of the strike shortened season. They carried an extra catcher. And then once they had to cut down to the regular 25, they put him on waivers and he was picked up by Cincinnati. Cincinnati. And then I came up a month later, so we never got to play on the same team together, although we came up through the minor league system together.
So you played in a lot of teams, too. You played as a little leaguer together?
Oh, yeah.
You played as Babe Ruth together?
Babe Ruth, little league, Legion Ball. High school, we went to St. Bernard with Eastline. We played against each other. We beat them in the state tournament my junior year. Didn't play each other my senior year. And then in professional ball, we played in Florida State League together. We played Binghamton together. We played Norfolk together. We played in Arizona Fall League together. Played in all the instructional leagues together. We were very close.
Is he still... I'm sorry.
No, you're okay.
Is he still around?
No, he lives in Stuart, Florida.
And we touch base every once in a while. Like everybody else.
I did talk to him.
Oh, I could definitely. I could definitely set that up. Yeah, absolutely. I'll call him and I'll have him...
I got to turn this off because I don't want this on the tape, but I want to tell you this.
Okay.
I have a good friend of mine that getting back to the rookie ball, and then you went to high A? You jumped to high A?
Yeah, I skipped their middle A, which was in Carolina, Myrtle Beach, I believe. No, Columbia, South Carolina. So I went from my first official spring training. I made it to a full season team, so I'd have to stay extended, which was fantastic. I went to the Florida State League and pitched with a pretty good group of guys. Brooke was my catcher, so now I had him behind the plate. We're living together. It was a great relationship. Had a great time down there. I put up good numbers. Again, wins and losses were never great early on. I think it was 10-12, but I had a low. I had like a 3 ERA. My numbers were starting to get more consistent. I was throwing more strikes. Mechanically, I was becoming a better pitcher, and it was a long season. It was a hot season, but it was it was a good group of guys, good camaraderie, and it was definitely a really fun time of my career.
At what point now? Now you're a potential major leaguer.
Yeah.
Now you're saying I'm making the majors.
You know what's funny? Even early on, I always thought that sooner or later they're going to find me out that I don't belong here.
Really?
You know, I think I was still kind of in that wishy-washy. As much as I felt comfortable, I was like, you know, I just knew there were other guys coming along, and I was confident in what I could do, but I just, I don't know. I felt like at every level I had to prove myself. You know, I had to go out and do well. I had to, it's not just handed to me right now. I gotta bust my tail in order to compete at this level. And I thought the double-A guys were just awesome. I remember being in A-ball, going to for some reason, I think it was a double-A spring training game or something, and watching those guys play, I'm like, oh, my God, those guys are awesome. And then you realize once you get there, they're not awesome. You're as good as they are. And the same thing at triple-A. I watched a triple-A team work out during spring training. You know, with A-balls, we'd be walking by, they'd be having a game. And just watching these guys play, I'm like, yeah, they're incredible. And then when you get there, you realize, it takes you a little while, but you realize there's nothing different about the game. And the same thing happened in the major leagues. You know, I'm thinking, I remember going to major league spring training games, you know, with a couple of guys after an A-ball workout. They'd have a game against the Dodgers, see the Mets and the Dodgers, or see Darling pitching or whoever. And watch the game, it just looks so different to me from the stands. It looks so incredible. I'm like, there's no way I'm ever going to get there. And then you get there, and it takes you a little while, but you figure out that you're as good as everybody else, and it's no different. Obviously, it raises your level a little bit, your level of play, but I think I always felt like I was a step behind, and until I got there, I needed to succeed in order to have that confidence. That's strange, but...
How about, now, the Mets, you go up, you pitch with the Mets. Pitch what, 2 or 3 games?
I pitched a few games. I pitched with the Mets. I came in relief. I pitched for maybe a month, a little over a month, until the All-Star break, and they sent me back down.
So what was that like, that first time getting sent down?
That was difficult, but you know what, I think I was a realist at that time, and I knew that I wasn't throwing great, and I knew that there were some other good pitchers. It was tough. I think at the time, Jason Isringhausen came up and took my spot. Bill Pulsifer was there, and Isringhausen was dealing in AAA, closing games, or starting, he just started that time. And I was pitching out of the bullpen. I was like a roller coaster. One game I'd throw well, the next game I'd give up three runs. I'd walk guys, and I'd throw a good game. And it was never the consistency that I knew they were looking for. And I wasn't nearly as sharp because I kind of got off a routine. And I was in AAA, I was closing. I was throwing every other day. If not, you know, they'd get me in there. If I had a couple days off, it was like they had to get me in. Anyway. So I got into the big leagues, and the situation changed. I was more of a long guy, mop-up guy. Then I'd get a couple innings in a key situation. It was never the consistency, and I struggled with that at that time. And I needed to have a routine, and I really struggled early on because of that until I kind of figured out that, you know, sometimes not having a routine can be the best thing as far as being a reliever. But, so being sent down by, I remember Joe McElvain Dallas Green called me in and said, "Hey, Pete, you know, we're doing a good job, just not good enough right now. You need to get sharper. You need to get more consistent. You need to send you back down to AAA to close more games out, get the ball more. You're not getting it enough right now, and we're just making a change. You know, keep working. I know you got the fire in your belly." I remember him saying that, "Dallas Green, you got the fire in your belly. You'll be back here." And it was tough. You know, you feel like you've disappointed. You feel like you've let somebody down because they built you up. They wanted you to get up. I mean, they let Josias Manzanillo go at the time. They wanted me to come in and be another stopgap in that bullpen, and I didn't provide that the first time. And it was the first time where I'm like, man, maybe I'm not good enough. Maybe it's going to be tougher than I thought. So I went back down to AAA, and then I struggled in AAA for the first couple of weeks because I think it happens a lot. Guys get sent down, and they think they're just going to go back down and walk through these guys, you know, and you realize quickly that they're very good too, and they're going to take your head off if they can. And so then I got back on track, and then I got back up at the end of the season.
Then you start moving around, right?
Then I start bouncing around. So I went from being a guy who, you know, at that time I thought, once I get there, you don't realize, you think you're going to be there forever. And then all of a sudden it's taken away from you. And that's the first time it was taken away from me. And then the following spring they traded me to San Diego in spring training. And I ran into an injury over there with my shoulder, had my first shoulder surgery. So, I mean, it's a good example of kind of building someone up. You get in there, you climb in that ladder, you get all the way there, and you think, all right, I'm here. This is it. I'm good. I'll be here for 10 years, 15 years, and it doesn't happen that way. You know, you gotta produce up there, and you gotta keep producing on a daily basis. So.
The key is Toronto. Getting to Toronto.
Yeah.
How did you get to Toronto?
You know, after the whole, you know, 3 or 4 years of knee and shoulder surgeries and pretty much being out of baseball. Toronto, I started the year off with the Norfolk Tides under John Gibbons again. John Gibbons wasn't there that year. He was there the year before. I started off with the Norfolk Tides. I had a great spring training. I had a good year the year before. I put myself on the map. There were a lot of teams that were aware that I was throwing the ball really well again. And I started the year off in AAA, made maybe a start, one start, and they called me up to New York. Filled in for Kobayashi or I don't know what his name was. He was a Japanese pitcher that was there. He was supposed to be the next the Greg Maddux that Bobby Valentine brought over, and he struggled. So he got hurt. They called me up right away because they promised they would call me up. They restructured my whole contract at the end of spring training. They didn't want to let me go. They were very good to me. They promised that if something happened, I would be the first guy called up. So they held to their promise. They put me on the roster. They designated somebody else. I got up there. I stayed there for maybe a week. 7 to 10 days. I pitched a couple of times. You know, I didn't really get the ball a lot. It was kind of disappointing because I felt like I was really ready to make an impact. And they decided to designate me when the pitcher was healthy again. And they knew that this was going to happen. They knew they might lose me through waivers. And sure enough, Toronto snapped me up. I got a call from J.P. Ricciardi and, you know, very happy to have me. You know, they're flying me out in the morning. You know, they're looking forward to giving me the ball up there. So I got on a plane, and next thing you know, I'm in Toronto. And I remember sitting down with Buck Martinez, and he sat me down in the dugout and said, "Pete, just want to let you know I had to talk to Bobby Valentine." I'm like, "Oh, is this good or bad?" I didn't know, you know, because they let me, you know, they designated me and didn't really give me a great opportunity. But he said, you know, "You need to pitch your game." He told me one thing: you need to pitch your game, not what the catcher's calling. You need to throw how you pitch. You need to pitch how you have learned how to pitch. You know, you became a pitcher. You're no longer a thrower. you need to go out and do what you want to do. So I think that was the then I would kind of go along with the catcher and got out of my game sometimes. I said, all right. So it was great to hear. Sure enough, I started pitching the way I pitched in AAA. You know, I didn't throw more fastballs because the catcher's throwing a fastball on a fastball count. I'd throw my changeup. I'd throw my backdoor cutter. I'd throw a split finger. And I started pitching and having fun pitching. And I ended up having a very good season with Toronto. And Buck Martinez was good. He got fired during the season. But he really was great to me early on. Gave me the ball. There's some articles and quotes that he said that I was a savior to the bullpen because they were really struggling at the time. And then I pitched in every role you can imagine. I spot started. I closed a couple games. I set up. I pitched in long relief and kind of spelled the starters who were really struggling at the time. So that's when I knew. Once I got into about 2 or 3 weeks, I knew I was pretty secure there. I could just tell. I felt comfortable right away. They were fantastic to me. And I had a feeling that I was in a good situation.
Now, looking back, those 2-3 years in Toronto.
Yep.
Right?
4, actually.
All right. Yep. That's what we're going to remember Pete Walker for.
Yeah, definitely. And to be honest, that's what I remember about my major league experience. I really want to. You know, the New York situation was never really a situation where they just said, here's the ball, you're getting it for the next 2 months, and we're gonna get you going. And sometimes that's what you need, or I did, and I know there are a lot of pitchers out there that could be successful if they're given that opportunity, but some players have such a short leash that they never get that opportunity. But my memories of Major League Baseball were the Toronto Blue Jays, pitching against the Yankees, the Red Sox, battling some of those guys, and Manny, and A-Rod, and David Ortiz, and pitching in Toronto, coming off to a standing ovation against the Yankees for one of my relief appearances, coming in there and getting out of a couple of tough situations, and those are the memories I'm going to have of my major league experience. Will be definitely Toronto experiences.
Is it so? There was a point in Toronto where continue with this emotional thing.
Yeah.
Where you said I'm a major league.
No question. For the first time. Felt like it in New York. Never felt like it when I was called up in San Diego. Never felt like it in Colorado when I got called up. I always felt like I was I don't think I earned the respect of my teammates. And once you earn the respect of your teammates, where someone comes up to you after a game, a major league game, and says, that's an awesome job. And that's when you're like, wow. But until you hear that, you never feel like you belong. You never feel like you're in the clubhouse talking. The guy's talking in the clubhouse, fooling around. Yeah. You're kind of an outsider. But once you have some success at the major league level, it's amazing how you feel that level of confidence and success and feeling like I belong here. And that's when I first felt it. They gave me the ball right from the get-go. I had some success, and it just kind of bloomed from there. I just wish I had that, back in 1995. And maybe things would have been, it might have been a different major league career, because I hate to say it.
What you're doing now as an instructor.
Yeah.
Do you carry that forward?
No question.
I mean, do you tell a little leaguer you are a legitimate little leaguer?
Yeah, I do. And I think it starts at that level. Because there are some kids that I can just tell that come in with low self-esteem, not a lot of confidence. They just want to be able to compete. They're not looking to be a Major League Baseball player. They want to go out there with their teammates and feel like they belong. And we get all types. We get kids that are exceptional. And then we get other kids who haven't picked up a baseball before. So you get both ends of the spectrum. And you want to make sure that kid that's struggling just throwing the ball feels good about himself. You don't want him to be, because, some kids, if they're taught right or they're in the right environment, can actually be productive as a ball player. And you don't want them to, because of their lack of self-confidence or self-esteem, quit the game or go play lacrosse or soccer, which is fine, but I'm saying you don't want them to give up on something because they don't feel like they belong.
Do you think now, Peter, that hurt you a little bit?
Definitely.
That lack of self?
No question. And I don't know why I had it or why it was there, but I never gave myself enough credit. I always felt like I was second tier. I don't know why. I didn't get that feeling until I was late in my career. But there were times when I had it in AAA, I had it in the minor leagues, and just couldn't get it in the major leagues. I couldn't get that feeling, but again, it always took me a little time at each level. It was never there. It wasn't like I went into AAA thinking I'm going to tear it up this year. I'm going to get up here, see what happens, and then I get hit a couple of times. Battling and wearing,
Not that I was an emotional guy in the field. Nobody would ever know that. I remember talking to John Gibbons about that. He said, that's... I remember talking to him about this a little bit. You know, you guys are finally given the opportunity they're looking for. You know, and he came in a couple years after the fact. You know, he wasn't there for my initial stay in Toronto, but we talked about that. And you know, my feelings over the years, it's like, I would have never known. I'm like, well, that's the truth, though. You know, I always felt like I didn't quite belong and, you know, always had to prove myself. Which isn't a it's not a bad thing, but yeah. It can work against you in some ways, too, you know?
But
it kept me hungry, but it never... But I think my confidence level should have been higher than it was.
But Toronto was where you got it. Toronto
definitely.
Was where... At Toronto, you felt you were a legitimate major leaguer.
Toronto, yes, and I also felt... when I pitched that season in Norfolk, and I went 13-4, and I was the top pitcher in the International League, and led in every category, and you know... I think at that point, too, I felt like I need a shot now because I feel as good as I've ever felt, physically, emotionally, mentally. I know I can compete with those guys. I was older. I've seen some of the guys who are up there doing well. I'm like, there's no way those guys are better than me. And that's how I felt. There was no way that I was not going to get a shot at this point. Unless
Who'd you play for in Norfolk?
John Gibbons. He was my manager in 2001. And I knew that year. I mean, it was the first time really in my career where I was the guy. On a minor league team, I was they wanted me on the mound. Every big game, they wanted me on the mound. You know, I heard the comments when I was pitching. Hey, who's pitching today? Walker's pitching today. All right, here we go. We're gonna win this one. Or, you know, things like that. You know, let's just score one run today. All you do is score one run today, boys. You know, something like that.
Do you think other professional baseball players go through the same emotional rigor?
I think they do. I think there's also different ends of that where some guys are so confident. That it can work against them because they get kind of an attitude. Certain guys don't pull for them. Certain guys don't like them. Organizational people almost want to see them fail because they're so cocky and arrogant and egotistical. But I think there are a lot of ball players like me that's why. And I was fortunate enough to hang on and get the opportunity because a lot of guys in my situation, they get to those late 90s, still battling the bug, got a family. They just, that's it. I'm done. I can't take it anymore. They get disenchanted. Where I feel that, you know, there are quite a few players out there that have that same feeling. Because I can walk into a clubhouse and I can tell who's having a good season, who's struggling mentally, you can just tell right away how they're interacting with other teammates. It's true. You can see it.
You know, a lot of teams handle their minor leagues differently. You know, like the Twins want baseball people. You look down the Twins managers.
Yeah.
Right? They're baseball guys. Yeah. Guys that have been in the game for a long 20, time. 30 years. Then you look at the Yankees, they got a lot of educational guys. A lot of guys that have spent a lot of time, you know, in college or high school. Yeah. Bobby Schaefer is a perfect example.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, I mean, guys that get them like more... educators more than they. I don't know. I guess I think maybe some teams realize what you went through.
So you're saying you appreciate what Minnesota's doing, or you?
No,
you're
I don't
saying,
know if
you're
I understand
the other one.
I don't understand. I understand that. I was never aware of this problem till you and I just talked.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking now.
Differences
in their development.
Yeah.
I mean, the Yankees.
I think
have
the players'
always,
relationship is huge. I think finding out someone, I think it's a balance. You find someone that can do both, you got a great instructor, you got a great organizational man. But I've seen both ends. I've seen guys that are too friendly with the players too. And you're not always being told the truth by someone like that. You want someone who can tell you the truth, but still maintain a good relationship with you. You know?
Did you ever have anything to do with Stump Merrill?
No, I didn't.
I've heard a lot of great things. Well, there's a guy who was an old-time baseball guy who had and was also had a lot of education.
Yeah.
Stump was a master.
Yep.
You know, I mean, he certainly appeared.
Well, that's ideal, I think.
Well, I mean, he's certainly...
I look at the relationships I had, though, the guys that were most influential on me, and it was the guys who were caring and had good hearts they were tough at times, but they were definitely baseball people early on. You know, after Dak and Eamon, you know, they didn't have their masters, so they didn't have their, but they knew how to handle players, they knew how to get along, and it wasn't all about, you know, having a your strikeout to walk ratio. And your, it was, they knew, they could see in there, because you got to look beyond the numbers sometimes early on in minor league baseball. I think every organization does a pretty good job at that. It's not so cutthroat, but I just think, or black and white, I should say. But I think is you got to look to get more out of the players. You got to find a way to get it out of them. And every player is different. Every player needs a little. You know, you got to be able to be. You need to see that as a coach, that every player is a little bit different, and they need to be treated, you know, fairly or not fairly, but they need to be treated differently.
Could you see yourself as a coach somewhere?
Yeah, I could. I honestly, I think I'd be pretty good. I think I'd be pretty good because I can relate to the players. I've pitched in the major leagues. I've had a lot of ups and downs throughout my career. A lot of injuries, or not a lot, a couple of injuries that were significant. I've persevered through some tough times. I have a family with kids. So I can relate to a lot of issues and situations that players are going through. I think I learned a lot later in my career that I would like to pass on to some players earlier in their career if it would help them. I could definitely see myself going. I know J.P. Ricciardi would love me back in the Toronto organization. Maybe not as a player right now, but as a you know, next year, you know, as a coach, maybe front office, whatever, dealing with players, player personnel. So I think the part of me would like to do that, but the other part of me loves being home with my family. I have three girls, and I don't see myself traveling so much anymore. I'd like to do, you know, if this were a 9-to-5 job, it'd be ideal. You know, and I'd just stay here and do it. But unfortunately, this job is in the evenings and the weekends. So, you know, I'm spent enough time away from my family where I enjoy being home. Could I jump right back into baseball and have a long career in baseball as a coach? There's no question. I know I could go back to the Mets, the Blue Jays. I've made good relationships with every organization that I've been in. And I don't think that'd be a problem. But I just, I think the biggest challenge to me would be being away from my family anymore than I have been.
You know, I ask this to every pitcher. Who hit the longest home run?
Soriano. Soriano with the Yankees. He hit one into the fourth deck up in Toronto. It was an absolute bomb. The only good thing about that, a week later, or a few days later, the same surgery, I think made me feel bad. It was Josh Phelps. It went off of Clemens into the upper deck in Toronto. He was like only the fourth or fifth player to ever do it. You know, Canseco had done it, a couple other guys. But he hit like 3 days later, which took the pressure. People, I was hearing about that home run. He went in the fourth deck up there. It was just an absolute bomb. And fortunately, a few days later, it took the, you know, everybody was concentrating.
So you
Josh
played,
Phelps'
you
home
played
run.
With Clemens.
I played against him. You know, I pitched against him up there. He was in the, you know, with the Yankees. I had a chance to meet him personally in Florida because we were both rehabbing in Tampa. You know, this past year he was down there. Remember before he came to New York, I'd signed with the Yankees and was hoping to be ready in time. And, you know, I talked to Brian Cashman and he said, hey, you can get yourself ready. Our bullpen is struggling right now. This is in June. You know, and then all of a sudden Hughes got healthy and Carson's got healthy and Ferris and they signed Clemens. So all those the spots.
This was last year.
Last year,
yeah.
And you know, I was actually going to sign up. I was already made a verbal commitment to Boston. I was going to go down to extend the spring training. I talked to Ben Sherrington. Everything was set. And then the day before, Gil Patterson, who was my pitching coach in Toronto, was the minor league coordinator with the Yankees for rehabilitation down there, and called me up and said, "Where are you? What are you doing? How close are you?" I said, "I'm about 2 weeks away. I'm ready to go. I feel great." I was throwing about 82, 83. Figured a few more weeks, I'll be back up in the high 80s. And so I went down there. They flew me down, passed my physical, and just wasn't throwing hard enough. And they're like, you're not 2 weeks away. You're like 2 months away. So they put me on a whole throwing program, slowed me down. And then by the time I was actually throwing better, I was up around 86, 87. Those guys were all healthy. They're like, you know what? You're not going to get the major league this year. We're not going to go throw you to Triple A. Now you can keep rehab, keep finishing the year out. I just said, this month going on. I appreciate it. You guys have been fantastic.
So how did it end now? How did not, it has not ended, but how did
nope. How does it end? I don't know yet.
No,
it
how did
end
the
this week.
How did it end?
Wait another week for the story.
I'm coming back to talk to you when it does, because okay. One of the greatest interviews I ever did was George Waltrip. I'm sure you
were
telling me when he knew it was over.
Yeah.
I mean, the tears coming down that big surge. Yeah.
No, I part of me, I'm going to throw today, actually. That's my nephew's probably looking for me. Sorry about that.
You know, and I'll do the same regard that again, you were telling me how you were with Toronto, right? And then they let you go?
Toronto, well, let's see. You mean spring training?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was difficult. I mean, I came off of surgery. I had surgery in July. You know, rehabbed all year, worked my tail off, came back into spring training, and they were, I think, very surprised at how I came into camp. I was actually throwing the ball. And, you know, this is less than 7 months removed from major shoulder surgery. So I think I shocked them a little bit that I was even, you know, able to come and throw. I threw in 4 games. Physically, I looked great. Just my range of motion wasn't quite all the way there in my recovery. I didn't really tell them, but the next day after I threw, I would still feel a weakness, a fatigue in my shoulder. So I wasn't physically ready. I wasn't ready at all. Can you hold 1 second? I'm sorry. That's okay. What's going on?
Ronnie.
So they let you go.
I had a good spring. I actually threw in 4 games, and, you know, there was a situation where I surprised them that I was even competing. I actually threw pretty well. Just velocity wasn't quite where it needed to be. So we had a long talk. They were basically, I had a release. I had an out clause at the end of spring training. So if I did happen to throw really well, they weren't going to keep me on the major league team. They could just send me to AAA. You know, it was an opportunity for me to get out. It was, I decided to, exercise that option of not staying in extended spring training and rehabbing for 2 months or continue throwing. I was at the point where I knew I needed a little more work. I could continue rehabbing at home. I could throw at home. I could work out at home and be with my family. So I kind of opted out of the contract at that point, asked for my release, and they, obliged. So, they were good about that. And then I went home. You know, we left on good terms. I talked to JP. I talked to Gibbons. I talked to, Brad Arnsberg, the pitching coach, who were, very disappointed that I was going to leave at that time. But I saw the handwriting on the wall. They made a few moves in the offseason. I was kind of on the outside looking in as it was, plus coming off a shoulder surgery. I thought maybe it was time just to move on and continue rehabbing and maybe get an opportunity with somebody else. And that's what I did. So I went home, continued rehabbing, and sure enough, a month and a half, 6 weeks later, continued to throw, get stronger. And that's when the Yankees, Gil Patterson, we connected. He gave me a call, wanted to know how I was feeling. And then I went down and gave it a shot with the Yankees. So physically, I wasn't 100%. I pushed the envelope last year. Look, Dr. Andrews, who did my surgery, said it's a rehabilitation year. It's the way it is. Don't kill yourself. Don't re-injure yourself, or then you're really done. So I didn't really take his advice. Fortunately, I didn't re-injure myself. It just took longer than I thought.
I asked you about the longest home run. Is there one strikeout that you remember? One really key pitch other than the one against Georgia?
I think there was some, one pitch striking out Sammy Sosa when he was with Baltimore. It was a spot start. They were hoping to get maybe 50 or 60 pitches out of me. I ended up pitching into the sixth inning. I got through 5 2/3. I was up over close to 80 pitches, and they were at the point where they wanted to get me out of the game, so they knew I was pushing it on short rest, and I threw out of the bullpen 2 days before. And I got into a bases loaded jam in the sixth inning. We were winning, I think it was maybe 2-1. It was a tight game, and I had Sosa up there with one out. But I knew it was my last hit. It was a left-hander coming up. They had a left-hander warming up the bullpen. And I got to a full count with him. And I know he wasn't the Sammy Sosa of old, but he was still, at that time, he was doing
this
okay.
This was 2 years ago?
This was 3 years. When was he in Baltimore? 3 years ago?
3 years ago.
Yeah, something like that. He was on his swan song. But just the idea, it was a key situation. He's still Sammy Sosa. He could put the bat on the ball and drive it out of the yard any time. And I threw him a sinker that I have on tape that just dropped about 2 feet. And he swung and missed the ball. And I think people sensed that it was my last hitter. The lefty warming up and punched him out and came off to a nice ovation. It was a strikeout that I remember as being a pitch that I had to make. I was getting out of that situation. It was a spot start, and it was facing Sammy Sosa, and I got a chance to punch him out. So.
How, you don't remember any other ones? I mean,
yeah, I mean, there's quite a few. I mean, you know, I think a couple of key situations, striking out Alex Rodriguez and Manny Ramirez, you know, in some key situations. You know, anytime you can strike out any guys of that caliber,
yeah.
You know, you feel pretty good about yourself. You know, I think everybody envisions maybe getting a chance to face one of those guys someday, you know, and you know, I had the opportunity to face them a number of times, and you know, I think striking those guys out and seeing them walk back to the dugout was a great feeling. You know, it was a feeling of accomplishment. Even regardless of the game itself, you face a marquee player. You know, you face A-Rod, Manny, Ortiz, the Giambi in his prime, you know, it was whatever, that era. And, you know, you face some of those guys and have a chance to strike them out. And that's a great feeling. Not that I'm a strikeout pitcher, but those I remember those.
Would you have rather pitched in any other era, or are you happy with the era you pitched in?
I think if I had to do it over again, I would have preferred the era that's coming up right now, or maybe early 90s. You know, I mean, my era was definitely a scandalous era. You know, that I saw a lot of big ball players at home plate, and I knew. You know, looking at my physique and you know, looking back and seeing the numbers now, how they're coming down a little bit, I pitched right in the heat of it, to be honest. My best time was right, you know, the early, you know, 2001, 2002, 2003, when it was very evident. You know, obviously mid-90s as well, but...
Now, you brought that up.
Yeah.
I didn't bring that up.
Right.
You brought that up. Are you pissed about that?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, there's definitely a part
of me...
Excuse
me for pointing.
No, it's fine. There's a part of me that's, I guess, real upset about it. And, you know... As oblivious as I was to it, as a you know, in general, you know, because I was so into what I was doing and concentrating, you look back and you see the physiques on some of these ball players and the home runs they were hitting that should be fly balls and you know, and you're competing against that. It's just an unfair advantage, period. And I don't think anybody would disagree with that. But there was this, you know, there's been, I know that I'm sure there were players out there, not just position players, pitchers, who are doing it, I'm sure. And, you know, I think that bothers me that guys maybe were taking my job at the time, you know, and I was battling. And, you know, sure, I could use a 95 on our fastball, you know, or whatever. And I just think that, you know, that bothers me because I think it definitely affected my career in some ways. You know? No question.
Okay, but it definitely gave those hitters.
No question.
I mean, you must have faced some guys that were juiced up.
You know, I guess for me personally, did I ever see them? No. But do I suspect that they were doing it? Absolutely. You know, just based on the physical, the numbers, jumping, you know, going from a 10 home run guy to a 40 home run guy, or whatever, you know. I mean, it was just, it's just disappointing, I guess.
Was it this tight little group that was doing it? You know, that's what's hard for some of us to believe,
yeah.
Peter. The other guys didn't know it. We assume everybody wasn't doing it. But it's hard for us to assume that.
Do I think the numbers are like Jose Canseco's? No. I mean, his numbers, I think, are very large.
Yeah.
But I think it was a significant amount. You know,
but you weren't aware of it.
No, that's what's...
That's what's hard for people to understand.
That's the truth. And it wasn't something, you know, the groups, I guess maybe the players that I hung out with were different. Maybe it's just the, you know, your circle of friends maybe is in all walks of life, or people that you can relate with, and things that, you know, they kind of have things in common. So I wasn't around guys that did it. But do I suspect guys that did it? Absolutely. And you know, did anybody ever discuss it with me? No. That's the truth. Did I ever try to find out? No. You know, I guess I'm as guilty as some people as far as turning your, you know, just saying whatever, you know. But I think the management made, I mean, they're the first to admit now that they definitely turned their back on it. And, you know, and they're paying the price now. But I just think it was evident. It was nothing that was ever discussed in the clubhouse. I mean, I think the general public thinks there were steroids being passed out, you know,
exactly,
by teammates in the clubhouse, and that's the farthest thing from the truth.
If anybody was doing it, they were doing it in the privacy of their own house or whatever. It was never something that was out in the open, by no means. And I honestly had never heard anybody discussing it as far as doing it. That's the truth. But players had discussions about maybe people they suspected. Absolutely. You know, you could tell. And you'd hate to be, you know, suspect someone who wasn't doing it. That's the unfair part.
But let me ask you this. If you wanted to, you could have. You could have found
a way to do it. Hey, no question. Anybody could. Anybody could. Just like going down to the Powerhouse Gym or going to going anywhere. You know, it was just evident. People could do it. And in baseball, I'm sure. No question.
I mean, if you had the inclination.
If I had the inclination, there's no question it could have been done. Definitely. But you know, the issue is the long-term effects on these people that we don't know yet. You're going to see down the road.
Yeah.
And you know, the Lyle Alzado stories, and that, you know, if it was as evident as we suspect, then there's going to be people that are going to come down with a lot of ailments.
Terrible
ailments. So I mean, that's, you know, and that's probably the, for kids out there, for anybody out there that, you know, has been around it or had the opportunity. That's it. It's not so much the short term effects. Cause, yeah, you can physically get stronger, but it's the long term effects on your health.
Does sending my kid here help that? Does sending my kid here give that kid a better chance to not get involved in that?
I definitely, because we emphasize, obviously, it's more about confidence building. It's more about feeling good about yourself, getting the most out of your ability, not taking shortcuts. It's if you want to be a major league baseball player, you have to work hard. Number one, you have to have good mechanics, whether it's your swing or whether it's your pitching delivery. But you have to also have a good head on it and understand that you have to take care of your body. You have to treat your body like gold and do everything you can to keep yourself healthy. But it's more than just it's really the whole concept of becoming a better person. I think becoming a better person, better ball player, I mean, that's more important than hitting a 450-foot home run.
What I'm thinking, talking to you, and I can't, every step was important to you.
Yeah.
Absolutely every step in your career was important to you. From Little League to Toronto. Every step.
Yeah. No question. And my wife cracks up sometimes because I remember things that happened in Little League, or things that happened in high school, or plays, or, I just think, and that's the way it should be with everybody. It doesn't, you don't just happen to end up in the major leagues. It just doesn't happen. I mean, there are definitely, you know, as much as I wasn't on a mission early on, I definitely took every step and took every step seriously. And, you know, like every kid, you have a dream. But it wasn't my mission to be a Major League Baseball player. I worked hard at every level. I tried to succeed at every level. I never was content with mediocrity, you know, or being okay. I always wanted to be good. I did want to be good. I wanted to be the best, you know, and, you know, with limited ability. You know, I think I'm a good athlete, but, you know, I think I always had to push myself to be better.
You look back now, 24 Major League wins.
Yeah.
There's a lot of guys that don't have 24 Major League wins. If nothing happens more, if you don't get back, are you content?
Yeah. You know, obviously I wish I could have done more. You know, wish I could have done more. I feel like I could have done more. But the fact that I was, I think if I had never gotten that opportunity to kind of establish myself a little bit in a small way, that would have been harder to swallow. You know, because I put so much into it. But I made a lot of great friends along the way and a lot of great relationships. And I think that, you know, the fact that I did what I did, I won some of those games, I pitched against the best in the world, and, you know, and had some success. You know, I think that's, I am content with that. And I feel good about myself. And even if I didn't do that, I know I would have felt good about myself, but I would have always felt there was something missing. Like, you know, I just didn't prove it to myself.
We talked about these players that came in with marginal talent, all right, at the risk of venting your spleen here,
yeah.
Do you put yourself in that league? Did you have to fight? Did you have to earn that?
I think I did. You know, I wasn't I wasn't heralded as a huge prospect. You know, can't miss. So anytime you're not that, you